Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes. This is the audio diary of my life on, I believe, the 26th of October. And it's one of those days that I have been waiting for. The Saturday and the Sunday. And no interviews. Ah, I have videos to go out from previously in the week where I've had two a day. So I have, can't remember now whether it's three videos that need to go out. I think it's three. But thankfully, I do not have to record any today. It's not because I don't like doing them or anything. People are extremely interesting and I have some fascinating interviews with them, of course, and people hopefully have seen that over the years. However, it's nice just to have a break from being pinned to the house. I'm writing a book and I want to get on with the writing. It's going pretty good at the moment. First draft, so, you know, it's just getting the ideas on paper, but we are progressing with the writing, and I'm very thrilled about that. Let us talk about writers. Let us do that. Thank you for the contact who emailed me and was telling me about my metaphysical world theory and how accurate I was. That's very kind of you. The 26th, I think I said just now, didn't I? And this is from Gilbert White, 1783. He says of this day in Hampshire, "If a masterly landscape painter was to take our hanging woods in their autumnal colours, persons unacquainted with the country would object to the strength and deepness of the tints, and would pronounce at an exhibition that they were heightened and shaded beyond nature," which I think is a lovely thing to say about the autumn colours. In fact, we drove to the farm shop the other day, and I got Julia to do the driving on this occasion, so not particularly for this reason, but it enabled me to peer out of the window without having to concentrate on the cars on the road. And I was studying the beautiful colours, the trees, and I just thought, you know, we're at the height at this moment now of the colours, it seems to me. You know, for a very short time, you get this very heightened moment. And then, of course, the coloration continues, but the leaves fall from the trees and you start getting towards the stark, wintry image of twigs going into hibernation, as it were, preparing. And, of course, behind the scenes, deep within the beautiful trees, is that motion of preparing for another year. And one wonders, trees being sentient creatures, but not sentient in the way that we are, having perhaps a soul or perhaps its own life, however they are, however they perceive themselves, if of course they have consciousness of themselves, one wonders what they would think of hundreds of years, many of them, going through the same thing year after year, relying on the sunshine and the photosynthesis for their food and the minerals and the, mitochondria, I think that's in the stomach, but the mycorrhiza, is it? One of the three, that is that fabrication, that spider's web of fungulated, there's a word for you, food and nourishment and communication. Anyway, William Cowper in 1790 in Buckinghamshire says this: "A yellow shower of leaves is falling continually from all the trees in the country. The consideration of my short continuance here, which was once grateful to me, now fills me with regret. I would live and live always." Was he by that, is he coming to the end of his life? The consideration of my short continuance. It's an interesting phrase, isn't it? It's an interesting way of putting it. "Which was once grateful to me, now fills me with regret. I would live and live always." I guess there is the sense life is temporary. And as you get perhaps closer to what you perceive to be your end, there are maybe regrets of things that you have not done. And I was thinking about talking about this in my video today, but I'm not sure yet. I will consider this. I will consider it, because sometimes I feel I have something to contribute, and I know people will laugh, and they won't really understand, because YouTube is a quagmire of opinion, counter opinion, and people with no opinion, but plenty of harsh words in their word pocket. Anyway, there was something that I was going to say, which I've now forgotten. I'm just cleaning my glasses. My eyes get pugged up, and the sleep crystallises on the rims. So the cat wants to go out and have a look through the window. I have yet to draw the curtains here because it is dark. But I think it's this weekend, is it not, that we do something to the clocks? So they go for. I still can't remember. I thought it was spring forward, lean back. Or is it lean forward, spring back? One of the two. I never really understand it. I wish they wouldn't fiddle with it. Time is an illusion anyway, isn't it? Is it not? We're running our lives by bloody clocks. We're running our lives by these odd conventions. And I don't think... I mean, they're helpful in a commercial world. We know that, of course. They're helpful in a commercial world. But why do we have to live in a commercial world? Well, we need commerce to make things, don't we? And to buy things and to keep us in the narrow, to stop us from actually having an abundant life, to stop us from living within the seasons, to stop us from thriving. That's really what the clocks are. It's another stick to beat us with. We have to be at work at a certain time. We have to be home at a certain time. We only have so long for our breaks in the work during the day. Our freedom has been restricted, and we now have privileges. And who gives out those privileges? Our masters. Well, this is where time plays into that. The idea was so that all the trains would run at the same time. And you can sort of see the logic of that. But at the same time, the division of seconds, minutes, hours that we all abide by, instead of abiding by our own intuition, our own gut, and our own sense of who we are and where we are. Why? The argument is that we don't need to work. That is, for me, a very strong argument, that people who go to work, depending on how you call work, if something is pleasant to do, is it work? It may be working at something, but is it a job? A job, again, the language is strange, isn't it? Employment, you can be employed, you employ yourself on things like making a chair or a cabinet because you need it yourself or you need it for your family. You write a book and you might consider you're going to work on the book. It is a labour. But at the same time, these words have that double meaning, that you are going to work at a job for an employer who will pay you for your employment. And these employers have now got out of hand, in which they are no longer real people, but corporations. That you're employed by something that does not even exist, that is only a concept in the mind of those that agree it's there. In other words, if you didn't agree that these things were in existence, they would no longer have the power that they have. you're no longer employed by a man, another man, unless, of course, you work for, say, a family-run business or a small business that is not incorporated, that you're employed by John, the window cleaner, to carry the ladder. And that, I think, is honourable, healthy employment. For if you have a problem, you talk to John. And you say, I'm carrying your ladder, but your ladder is too heavy. You expect too much. Or you have a lovely time with John and say, I enjoy carrying your ladder, for it gives me a certain pleasure and gives me strength. And we can converse together and laugh, whatever it might be, you know. But when it's a dead entity corporation in which you have to engage as a man or a woman with an office, with somebody who represents the office of, you are engaging in nothing. Yes, there is a man or woman who's having to make the corporation appear that it's real, but it is nothing. It is still not real. You, at the end of the day, the man or the woman who represents the company isn't the company, and the company isn't a thing. And the company cannot make decisions, only the man or woman who represents the company for the company's best interest, which may not be for the best interest of the man or woman who is employed by the company. And therefore, it isn't in the interest of the man, it is in the interest of the company. I want to read a bit more from The Changing Village, F.G. Thomas. I thoroughly enjoyed what we were discussing the other day. And I'm going to pick another random chapter to start at. There's a picture here, Rural Industries, yesterday. And there's a woman, she is at a spinning wheel. She has a interesting hat on her head, which is hard for me to describe. It's almost like a skull cap, but it's black. But it's a woolly hat with a clasp. She has a, what you imagine to be a 1940s dress. You can't see much of that. She has a cardigan or a jacket, I think, over. She is seated at a spinning wheel, spinning what looks like woolen yarn. And she looks active and happy, but whether she is or not is another question. There is another picture here of a new senior school, angular, triangular, and 1940s. I'm trying to find the beginning of a chapter. I keep skipping past them. It's just... Bear with me, my lovely caller. I'm just trying to find it. And the chapters are clearly long. Here we go. This must be close. Here it is. Chapter 6. Fresh Woods and Pastures New, on page 129. This book has so far been concerned mainly with a description of the social conditions from which form the context of any proposed reorganisation of rural life. But outlining the nature of this reorganisation, it is worth noting some aspects of the context from which many current proposals of this nature originate. Because whenever the land is discussed, certain habits of thought are manifest, obscuring the real and practical issues. Sometimes these habits are projected as theories for a new life in the country. Compared with the complexities of modern economic world, for example, country life appears to many townsfolk as simple, and country people as simple folk. Though it doesn't. The everyday story of country folk, the Archers, was depicted in that way, was it not? Rum-pa-bum-pa-rum-pa-rum-pa-rum-pa-ra-rum. Hello there. What are you doing today? Oh,
I've got to go and look after the sheep this afternoon, although they keep getting out of the pen.
Oh, dear. Well, have a good day. Rumpty-dumpty-dumpty-dump. Yes, the simple life of ordinary, everyday country folk. The work of the farm labourer demands skill and ingenuity of highly complex kind, while to be neighbourly in a village demands the discretion of the cabinet minister and the subtlety of a diplomat. But so widely believed this simple view that simple land reforms are proposed and accepted by people who would never be misled if similar direct reforms were proposed for industrial organisations, single taxes, nationalisation of the land, small holdings, land settlements, and the collectivisation of farms are examples of this belief in simple solutions. Be interested to see what they say about small holdings. People, a small holder, you're a holder of small lands. Well, maybe, but what you want is a series of small holdings of mixed ability. Not, there's no point them all being the same. Sometimes the people in the countryside believe in the simplicity and resist, and therefore any proposal, resist any proposal for reform. Do not worry about us in the isolated country parishes, a clergyman wrote recently. The more remote we are, the happier and more self-contained we are. There are certainly less jobs to fill, but enough now that the family of one is the rule. We do not hanker after town life. In fact, we look upon our town, the townsman, as inferior being to ourselves. We have plenty of amusement after work is over. We have our May Day, we rabbiting, dances, concerts, billiard matches, and once a year the flower show and harvest festival. We are quite as happy and contented as the townsman, so why worry? Very good point, actually. Another attitude, perhaps the oldest and most widespread of all romances, romances the country life. This treatment of the subject is popular with general readers, and the daily press has exploited this fact. Even the most staid weeklies give space to the latest bird arrival. The flight of the heron, or the autumnal scene. This romanticism is sometimes turned into a crude pantheism, in which the well-being of man is achieved through identity of nature. Last summer I spent hours and hours watching seagulls on the Cornish cliffs, and for weeks on end. Seagulls are extraordinarily responsive to changing weather conditions, and they are in perfect harmony with the ever-changing environment, while to watch seagulls going off singly on their joy flights is to witness individuals, life units, seeking relief from unadulterated enjoyment of being alive, free from the enervating influences of mass psychology. This form of self-projection is common. The result, however, obscures realities with illusions, undermines any critical analysis of the situation, and creates an illusionary world to be solved by illusionary reforms. Thus, romanticism replaces understanding, and action is atrophied. Yes, I think that's very true, actually. And, of course, we do have a lot of countryside books on my shelf here, which may be guilty of this somewhat romanticism now. But run forward in time, and I think that romanticism is what gives the countryside its cachet, its yearning. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean, I don't think, that the romanticism in and of itself is bad, because if that is strong to pull people back, even if the reality is somewhat harder and less, shall we say, pink-tinted glasses or whatever, rose-tinted glasses, if it is the reality is much coarser, then so be it. But we do need something to restrain the continual eating away of the countryside with the urban development, and the concreting over of it, and the somewhat, the advance of the uglification of this land with the urban sprawl and its bland nature and copycat, so that wherever you go seems to be the same. Nature in and of itself flourishes with variety. And that is a beautiful thing to watch and to witness and to pass through, so that as you explore across one part of the countryside to another part, and you take a journey across this land, the geology from the historic upheavals of the landscape has created not only a landscape in which the rock formation is so diverse and changes frequently, but the plants that grow, that one minute those that depend on lime and chalk and sand will change to those that are in clay and granite and elliptic limestone. You know, the different undulating surface of different geology will have its own effect, and not only in nature and the type of trees, plants, invertebrates, insects and so on, but also in man's earlier attempts to house himself with natural resources from the locality. And that has to be, does it not, the landscape's joyous contribution to the aesthetics of it, and then to not only the aesthetics, but I'm trying to express myself as clearly as I can, and the words are slipping away as if quicksand has nabbed them and pulls them under. It's not only the aesthetics, but it's the reality of living in that landscape. You are governed, if you like, by the natural forces and the nature of it. So if you, for example, you know, it is very stunningly beautiful in Wales, and some of the Snowdonian mountain ranges are absolutely stunning, but the hardship of farming will dictate certain types of farming, like sheep farming, for example, over vegetables and wheat and those sort of things, what you call that, cereal and things like that. So the landscape will demand what is best at certain points. That's not to say that in a small holding, hark at me, don't need the book, the landscape itself will dominate all of this, and you can, not to say that you cannot grow in some areas where there's small patches that will provide you with vegetables and some corn and various things. But the idea of monoculture, of one crop, barley, spring barley, mile after mile, in the Snowdonian mountain range, of course, is absurd. And so the mixed farming, so that people would perhaps grow a few turnips and a few parsnips and a few potatoes or carrots, whatever, some cabbage, in a small patch which has been fertilised by their sheep, and the soil has the minerals from what has washed down from the mountain, shall we say, the rocks, those minerals. And so that people will scrape a living, but they may also have hundreds of sheep or be part of that landscape. Julia and I read together aloud to one another, I Bought a Mountain, which is a fabulous book, I think, in the 50s or 40s even, in which the Canadian author recounts his few years living at the edge of Snowdonia, and it's a brilliant book. I don't know whether they ever made a film, but it's a brilliant book. And he talks about the sheep farming and the various enterprises that he did, and the fact that they did grow some stuff. And of course, other stuff was brought in. that you could be self-sufficient in even in the most bleakest environments, but you may find that the bleak environment has a dominating industry, if you want to call it that, like sheep farming, because of the hills were only suitable to that type of thing. And so what am I saying? That the landscape of this country is an amazing, it is an amazing place. I think it is, I am not experienced in many places in the world. I've been to Europe, I've been to America, and I have obviously seen television programs. I think the diversity of this country for its farming ability and for its housing stock and its geology is just what makes it, to me, heaven on earth. And the colours of autumn and the variety of trees and the undulating fields and the small hedgerows and the, you know, what we had before we blighted it, before the uglification and the blandation of this land, before the urban sprawl and the concentration camps of rabbit hutches in these forthcoming 15-minute cities of mean windows and awfully boring housing stock that has been abundantly given the green light by unimaginative governments who have an agenda fixed to them by unelected bureaucrats who have influenced all of this. Before all of that really got to the point where it was just overzealous and mean, this country, and it still has that capability, with a rejection of the policies that we are seeing. But it will take a lot of work. It will take a lot of work. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that some of my rantings here, inspired by these beautiful books, are of some interest. I don't know whether I espouse anything other than my own personal perception and whether any of it resonates with people. But this is the beauty of books, you see, the beauty of books. The beauty of other people who have thought, considered. You may not agree with all of it, and you don't even need to read the whole volume to take from it one idea and run with it and think about it. People don't do that. They rely on YouTube and bland computer games to... They don't sit and think. They don't ruminate. They don't cogitate. They do not spend significant time, because the powers that be that have made us believe that time is essential, that we go by the clock, to bring this back to the beginning, that these people that have kept us in this narrow path of working on the 9 to 5 and the commute and working for somebody else, rather than working for ourselves and making of us, and to live in these hovels that we live in, these luxurious hovels, I should say, with television and streaming media and off-gassing, brand-spanking, plasticated new EMF environment hovels that we believe are homes, disconnected from nature, with synthetic fibres all around. These places that we think are alive and well, which are really a reflection, full of dead entity corporation products. We need to break free from all of that. People are not thinking, not connecting with this world. And so you get that phrase, do we not? That phrase, which we started with, I will stop spouting this rubbish, but we will end when we will have that phrase in which one wonders the consideration of my short continuance here, which was once grateful to me, now fills me with regret. William Cowper, 1790, said that. And is it that we might regret the continuance of the short life amongst the objects that surround us and the landscape that no longer has the vibrance and life that it once had, thanks to our acceptance and continual acceptance and almost our praise for dead entities, corporations that are taking over this world and turning everything into a bland nothingness, a barren landscape of meaningless pap. Thank you for listening.